Welcome to Defining Moments, a program in which we get to know prominent people personally as they share the significant events, insights, relationships, and values of their lives. Defining Moments is brought to you on Christian Talk 660 by American Leprosy Mission, an international Christian ministry headquartered in Greenville, South Carolina. Defining Moments aims to build up the body of Christ by making its leaders better known to all of us. And now, here's your host for Defining Moments, Bob Smith.
Welcome to Defining Moments. Thank you for joining us. Today we'll get to know Dr. Brent Nelson, chairman of the Political Science Department at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. It's in the northwest corner of South Carolina, called the Upstate. Brent, thank you very much for telling us about your life today. We're looking forward to learning more about you, and we really appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks, Bob. It's really great to be here.
Defining Moments is about your life, of course, but first, tell us a bit about Furman University and your political science department.
Well, Furman University is a relatively small campus of 2,600 students nestled up against the Blue Ridge Mountains in South Carolina. And it's one of the elite liberal arts schools in the country. We draw top students from all over the country, but mainly in the Southeast. We're a small school with Division I sports, so that adds a kind of excitement to the campus on occasion if the basketball team is doing well. But within the campus, the political science department is actually the biggest department on campus, at least by number of majors. We
really?
Graduate about 100 undergraduates every year, so that's about 15% of a graduating class, which is pretty significant.
Yes.
For a small school, we have a lot of faculty members in political science. We're 21 faculty members, 17 of them are full-time. So we match up with many of the largest universities in the country in terms of numbers of faculty members and their specialties.
Now, what accounts for the fact that so many students are attracted to Furman and political science there?
Well, I think one of the reasons that political science has become so popular is we've worked really hard to meet the needs of this young generation that's coming up. What they really want are experiences beyond the classroom. And so we've developed internship programs, for instance, that have students down at local government or state government or national government, and we just started a Brussels internship program. So our students could go to any one of those places to experience politics at many different levels. We have foreign study programs led by Furman faculty members to Africa, to Latin America, to China, a couple to Europe. So what we provide students with is this exciting program that allows them to learn an awful lot in the classroom, but then to take that knowledge and experience it somewhere else. Mm. That's the value added. When you're going to pay $40,000 a year, you better get something for your money. And so that's how we get our students excited about learning. We tell them you're going to go see politics as it happens.
Mm, wonderful. Well, how old is Furman?
It's 186 years. Maybe my math is wrong, but it was started in 1826. Now, it didn't start in Greenville. It came to Greenville in 1850, and it was really a seminary before it was a liberal arts school. It became a university in 1850, and it was a bigger university. It was a kind of budding Vanderbilt or Wake Forest. It was modeled on UVA, actually, the Depression hit. Well, first the Civil War, and then the Depression, and that eliminated a law school and a medical school. But we kept the university name because that sounds cooler, especially to 18-year-olds. Mm-hmm. So it's an old school, but it has a new campus. We've been 50 years at our present campus, and that was one of the best things that they ever did. They moved from a very tight situation in downtown Greenville out to a much bigger campus, and that has allowed us to create this beautiful setting where learning, I think, takes place in a place that is most conducive. For learning.
It certainly is a beautiful campus. So you said it started as a seminary. Was it related to a church?
Yeah, it was Southern Baptist. Richard Furman, who put his name on the school, was one of the leading lights in the Baptist movement in the 18th century. He was a patriot from Charleston, pastored the First Baptist Charleston.
But it's not related to the Baptist Church now, is it?
No, and that's part of the painful history of Furman University, at least from my perspective. In the early 90s, late 80s and early 90s, a certain faction, a more conservative faction of the South Carolina Baptist Convention, began an explicit attempt to take over the institutions of the convention, and Furman was one of them. And they tried to pack the Board of Trustees with their own people. And out of that experience, Furman was able to use a legal loophole and break completely with the Baptists. There were threats of lawsuits, but in the end, nobody went through with them, and Furman is now a completely independent school as of 92.
Now, I understand that you are a co-founder with others of a new church. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Redeemer Presbyterian Church is a PCA church that will soon be located just out the back gate of Furman University. Several of us had a vision for planting an evangelical church, a vibrant church, near the Furman campus. And it was out of a small group of five families that this church has emerged. We're just ready to move into our new building in October, and we're very excited about it.
Oh, great. Well, you can tell us a little bit more about that later. Well, Brent, for the next hour, we're going to imagine that you've been given a fully paid sabbatical for as long as it takes to write your autobiography. But you'll need to do it alone, and we're going to put you in a beautiful but very remote cottage called Scribbler's Den. It has a great cook and housekeeper, but no TV, no telephone, no email, no internet. Just a word processing computer with dictation software, pens and paper, plenty of writing materials. You think you can stand to be alone for a little while?
Academics love sabbaticals, and the longer the better. And if they're fully paid, all the better. So okay. I'm with you right now.
Okay. Well, to help you get ready to write, we're going to ask you to recall the defining moments of your life. Those events, insights, people, decisions, mistakes that have changed your direction, that have helped you, that have attracted you, been your best accomplishments. But, of course, you can't write all the time, so you'll want to take some of your favorite books and music, perhaps other recordings, and we'd like to know what those are. Last, you can have two visitors from the past. We'll want to know who you'll choose and what you want to talk to them about. Sound like a good few days?
Sounds awesome.
We all have one defining moment in common, our birth. Tell us about yours. When, where, your parents, anything unusual?
It was a dark and stormy night in Grand Haven, Michigan in February. I was born in a snowstorm, and so that was perhaps the most unusual part about my birth. Otherwise, it went quite normally.
Okay. And your parents?
My father was a pastor at the time of a little Baptist church in Grand Haven, Michigan. We soon moved to East Lansing and then on to Wisconsin. But he was a pastor for a time. My mom was a school teacher, and so both of them were believers. They had gone to Wheaton College, didn't meet there. They actually met and got married very quickly. My dad was a little bit older, but it was a good household.
Natives of that area?
No, my father was a Norwegian immigrant, and so our home was culturally Norwegian, even if Dad was very much an American.
Your mother also a Norwegian?
Not quite as recent, but her grandfather was a logger in northern Wisconsin in the 19th century. So, yes, Norwegian.
So you're 100% Norwegian?
Except for a little German that got thrown in on my mom's side.
Oh, okay. All right. What would you say is your earliest memory or your favorite early memory?
Well, my favorite early memory is one when my mom woke me up early. I had to be about 4 years old, and she took me to the picture window in the dining room, and we looked out at the most perfect snow-covered morning that I could ever remember. The snow had fallen that night, and it had been about 6 inches, and the world was brand new, and beautiful sun out, and that has lived in my memory for a long time.
Is that your earliest memory?
It's not my earliest memory. My earliest memory is of my sister peeing on the living room floor, but we're not going to go there.
Okay. Right. All right. What would you say is your next defining moment before you started to school?
Well, I think it's not really a moment, but it's an atmosphere. I can remember the smells of the church nursery. The church nursery in Baptist churches, I don't know if you've ever gone through them, but there's kind of a mixture of urine and old Sunday school papers. It kind of gets mixed up in there. And the reason it's defining is because as a child of a pastor, the church was the center of our life. We were there all the time. And so I was in the nursery. I was in the Sunday school rooms. I was in the sanctuary all the time. And so that is kind of my most defining early moment.
Where did you start to school?
I went to a little school in Bath, Michigan, which is outside of Lansing. And it's just a rural school. My mom taught there. She taught third grade. And I don't remember a whole lot about the school because we moved to, we moved to Wisconsin fairly soon after that. But I can remember getting hot lunch, which they dished up in the classroom. And I gagged on coleslaw and never had another hot lunch as long as I lived. So that was a defining moment.
Not even at the Furman cafeteria?
No, I've eaten there. But that's a little bit different.
Do you remember your favorite subjects or favorite teachers back then?
Well, I fell in love with my first grade teacher, Mrs. Dean. My dad told me that she was quite beautiful, so I guess I had good taste. But I also remember being, you know, it was the first love that I lost as well, because I peered one day into the faculty lounge and saw her smoking with her friends, and I just thought that was distasteful. So she was no longer the love of my life at that point.
Oh, my. How about sports back then?
Well, the Green Bay Packers, this is after we moved to Wisconsin, they had just won their first Super Bowl. And so Wisconsin was Packer crazy, as, well, they always are. And I fell right in with everybody else, and it's, you know, my blood still runs green and gold. So football was big. I played backyard football. Of course, I played baseball and basketball. But I really fell in love with football and with tennis and with running. And those have, well, I've lost the tennis, but the running and the football have remained with me.
Was that back in the Bart Starr days?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, when the Ice Bowl and all of that. Those were big days for Packer fans.
Wow. Any favorite books back in those grade school years?
My mom, being a teacher, read an awful lot of books to us. The ones I can remember are really the chapter books, like Winnie the Pooh and Charlotte's Web. Those were books that I came to love, and she read them to us several times. So those are the ones I remember the most.
Watch TV?
Too much. My mother wouldn't let us watch any show that had guns in it. So Gunsmoke was out. As a baby boomer who doesn't know Gunsmoke, sometimes I feel left out. But we had a kind of tradition. One night a week, we would watch a lot of the sitcoms. And again, baby boomers will remember All in the Family and the Mary Tyler Moore Show and the Bob Newhart Show and Carol Burnett. And so, you know, we were into those sitcoms. The Waltons, of course, we watched. The world's best and most idealistic family. So, yeah. I watched too much.
What about movies?
My first movie was The Sound of Music. This was a big deal because my parents were fundamentalists, you know, largely from the old school. No dancing, no movies, no alcohol, no smoking. So in the middle 60s, they began to go through a transformation where they lost some of those rules. So we all went as a family to The Sound of Music. My mother was petrified that somebody from the church would see her. But we enjoyed it, and we went back to the movies.
Okay, great. What about musical instruments or singing? Did you do that when you were a child?
Well, music was part of the family. My mom playing the flute, we would hear all the time, and my mom and dad sang in church all the time. So music was part of the background that I lived in. When I was very young, it must have been 4 years old, 5 years old, I was given a toy organ for Christmas. It was a battery-powered organ. And I loved that little instrument, and I began to compose little tunes on it. And I think it defined me in some way. Now, I never played the organ. I played the piano for a little while. but music became a part of my life.
I don't suppose you still play the toy organ, but what about other instruments?
No, I don't play the toy organ, but I do play the guitar. And after my two requisite years of piano lessons, I said, Mom, I want to play the guitar. And so I got a few, like half a year of lessons. And as I've always said, guitar is the best instrument to learn to play poorly. And, you know, you can learn a few chords and pretty soon you can play simple little songs and you learn a few more chords and you can play more complex songs. So I'm not a great guitarist, but I can get by, and I love playing.
Great. Did you have any other passions in those preteen years?
Well, I fell in love a lot. And so I fell in love in kindergarten with a girl named Mary Rounds, and I called her every day and wanted to marry her. And so that was a passion, I guess, with one definition of the term.
Oh, wow. Have you always been that sort of romantic?
I hate to admit it, but I think so. I'm certainly glad that my romance is focused on my wife. But yeah, I was always a guy that had girlfriends. I was never very successful at keeping them, but I always liked somebody back in grade school.
Great. Well, what was your next defining moment?
Well, perhaps the most important defining moment as a young child was my conversion at age five.
Age five.
Now, you remember, my dad was a Baptist preacher in a rural church, and so we would have these evangelists coming through for revival weeks, and I understood what it meant to be an evangelist. This was a guy who preached the gospel, and people were to respond. And it was on one of those nights when the evangelist gave an invitation that I stood in my row and walked up to the front. Now, my mother thought I was just being a five-year-old kid and leaving to go to the bathroom at exactly the wrong time. But when she noticed that I was going forward rather than back, she was quite thrilled. And she was then the one that counseled me through the steps to receiving Christ as my personal Savior.
Do you feel you had a conviction of sin back then?
As much as I could understand at that point, yes. I understood that Jesus died for my sin.
Great. Scribbler's Den has a player for every kind of audio and video recording. Will you take any recordings like that with you?
Well, maybe unusually, I want to watch a movie. And I think it's unusual because I never have time, really, to watch movies a lot. But I love The Lord of the Rings. I love the Tolkien book, and I love the movies that were made from them. And I would like to spend some of this sabbatical just watching those movies.
What particularly attracts you to those?
Well, I think Tolkien understood perhaps the most fundamental story of humanity. We have lost our one true king. We have wandered from him. We've rebelled against him. And humanity's story is the search for that one true king. So I think Tolkien understood the message of the Bible, where God is establishing a community around the one true king himself, and then Christ as Lord when he comes in human form. And that's what draws me to this story, this myth.
We'll let you take that, but is there any music that you would like to take?
Like most baby boomers, I was raised on pop music, Fleetwood Mac and the Beatles. But I think for this experience, I'd like to bring Bach's Brandenburg Concertos. I was introduced to them in college, and that was the first time I understood beautiful music and understood that beauty could come through the ears. So, yeah, I love those concertos.
Okay, well, let's hear one of them now. Which one would you pick?
How about number six?
Okay, Bach's Brandenburg Concerto number six. Brandenburg Concerto number six. Now let's take a short break now. We have the most wonderful sponsor, and you really need to hear their message. When we come back, We'll talk about a book you'll take to Scribbler's Den and more about your early work.
Hello, I'm Chris Doyle, president of American Leprosy Mission. We are proud to sponsor this exciting new radio program, Defining Moments. For over 100 years, ALM has been working to bring healing and hope to those affected by leprosy. Leprosy is a tragic disease that robs people of their dignity, usefulness, and self-worth. But you can make a difference, a defining moment, if you will, in the life of someone with leprosy. Help us deliver the cure. Call us today at 1-800-LEPROSY or visit our website at leprosy.org. Thanks for listening and for caring.
Welcome back to Defining Moments. We're talking with Dr. Brent Nelson, chairman of the Political Science Department at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. Brent, tell us about your middle school years. What was life like back then?
Well, we lived in a suburb of Milwaukee called Brown Deer, and we lived in townhouses, so it wasn't really the most usual suburban life. My parents were struggling financially, and that was an important part of our life, this struggle, this financial struggle. Part of that was because of my father's experience at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Now, Dad had moved from the ministry, the full-time ministry in churches, to become a professor from the encouragement of one of his professors at Michigan State. And so he'd taken on this academic life, but you have to remember, this is the early 70s, and the universities have been radicalized. And my father was a Christian and relatively conservative in a department that had become very radical. They did strange things back then. For instance, when it came time every year to give people raises, the department would get together and they would take each member of the department and criticize each one in a sort of democratic fashion and then vote on their merit increases. Huh. Well, my father, being out of step ideologically with that group of people, first of all, struggled to get tenure, which of course is very important at a university. When he did get that, then he had this problem that he was never given merit pay. So we struggled financially because he was taking a stand as a believer in his university. And so it was just a long time before we could get a house. And that was part of my middle school years, this struggle to save money. I understood the cost involved in being an academic and being a believer.
So did you have another defining moment about that time?
Yeah, right about that time I had what I consider to be my spiritual awakening, and I think this is all wrapped in together. The specific moment was at a lake house that my aunt and uncle had in Massachusetts, and I remember laying awake at night wondering all those things that adolescents wonder. Where will I go when I die? Is there a mission to my life? Is there really a God out there? And I was very troubled. I could not sleep. I tossed and turned. And through that night, probably 3 or 4 hours into the wee hours of the morning, I finally said to God, very consciously, I believe you, and I commit my life to Jesus, and I will be committed for the rest of my life. And that has been very important to me because as life has gone on and there have been moments when I've wondered whether I should remain committed, I look back at that time and I said, I made a promise. And sometimes it has only been that promise that has kept me going. But I made that promise and I will continue to the end of my life saying, Jesus, my life is yours.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Scribbler's Den has a small library, the Bible in Hebrew, Greek, and every English translation, basic reference books like concordances and dictionaries, and for you, the U.S. Constitution and the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah.
And you can take several others. So what are the most important books that you'd like to take?
Well, I don't really think that's a fair question for an academic because I live with books. But I think I would take Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. It's a long book, so it'll occupy much of my time when I'm not watching The Lord of the Rings. But Tocqueville wrote in 1832, after he traveled across America, and his insights into society and religion and morality are still key today. Reading him again is reading America as it is today.
Mm. How about high school? What about favorite subjects, sports, arts, foreign languages, extracurricular activities?
Well, I went to Brookfield East High School. That's where I graduated from. I played football and I ran track, and in many ways those things defined me. I was pretty good at both, and so I had a kind of cachet on campus that helped me in other ways. I was able to be elected student body president, and part of that was academics, but part of it was sports. People just knew who I was. So in some ways, I lived that high school dream, especially my senior year. I wasn't a quarterback, and I didn't date anyone on the cheerleading squad, but I did a lot of things that are part of that American high school experience. I still was a believer, though, so I would always draw a line. I'd go to parties, but I'd leave at midnight before everybody got really drunk. I wanted to be popular, but I knew that there were lines to be drawn. But I would say that my experience in high school was a very, very positive one.
Did you work outside of schoolwork?
I did the normal things that high schoolers at that time did. In the off season, I worked at JCPenney's. I worked at a manufacturing plant where I actually worked on an assembly line, something that very few people get to do these days. I worked as a guy who played games with kids in parks and recreation. So I did lots of little jobs. Enjoyed all of them, actually.
Right. And did you go to college as soon as you finished high school?
Yep. I went to Wheaton College. I had been recruited for football and track by a couple of other bigger schools, even some Ivy League schools. But I made a very conscious decision not to go to those secular institutions. I wanted to go to my parents' alma mater. I wanted to go to Wheaton, where I knew I would receive an education, a good education, that integrated my faith with the knowledge that I was learning. So it was a tough decision in some ways, but not so in others. It was the only college I really wanted to go to.
And did you pursue political science immediately?
No, I wandered around a little bit, but I'd always loved politics. So when it came time to declare a major, I did declare a major in political science and enjoyed it very much.
Did you work during those years?
A little bit, not very much. I still played football and I still ran track at the collegiate level, so you don't get a whole lot of time to work outside. I did work for a while as a bouncer in a high school. It was my job to keep kids from smoking in the bathrooms, and they would hire big football players to do that kind of thing. It wasn't the most pleasant job, but I enjoyed it and got to know some kids I probably wouldn't have gotten to know otherwise.
What would you say is your next defining moment?
Well, after my freshman year in college, I was invited to be on a track team that traveled to Europe. It was a Christian team, so these were people from all over the country, men from all over the country, that were brought together to run, but also who had Christian testimonies. The idea was to run behind what we called the Iron Curtain back then. We went primarily to Eastern Europe. So places like Poland and Czechoslovakia, Romania, these were places that Americans didn't go very often. And I was able to, first of all, see Europe, and I fell in love with the continent. So that was very important to my later life. But secondly, I also saw the persecuted church. I can remember sitting in a Czechoslovakian church. It was not an underground church, but it was a church where the wife of the pastor was an American from Georgia, and she had married this pastor knowing that she could never go back to the States. And to this day, that moves me, because I knew this woman was so committed, first to her husband and secondly to his mission as an evangelical pastor in a communist country, that she was willing to forsake her family. Now, of course, she's been reunited with her family, but back in 1978, we had no idea that the Berlin Wall would come down. So to this forming Christian man, that kind of commitment was very, very defining for me.
Mm. Now, Scribbler's Den has an amazing device. It's called the Flux Capacitor. We bought it from the producers of the movie Back to the Future. Did you see that one?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Now, you know it allows time travel in both directions. So you're allowed to have two all-day visitors from the past to stay from the mid-morning through dinner. So you have a good visit. There's just one blackout period, AD 0 through 100. Who will be your first visitor, and tell us why you've chosen him or her?
Well, I'm going to bring Alexander the Great back.
Ah.
And this ties back to the Lord of the Rings, of course, because Alexander was probably the first Westerner who believed himself to be the one true king. And in many ways, I see Jesus as the antimatter to Alexander the Great's matter. Jesus was just the opposite of Alexander the Great. He didn't seek his own glory. It was given to him. He didn't defeat his enemies through the force of arms. He did so by dying at their hands. Now, why do I want to talk to Alexander the Great? I really want to know why he wanted to be the one true king. I want to know what drove him, what his passions were. Were they something, were they just internal, just about himself? Or did he have a vision for the world? I think it's the latter. I would like to know more about that. Partly because I think Alexander the Great understood the world as it is in its fallen state, not knowing the ruin, but living that kind of earthly glory. By understanding Alexander, I think I understand Jesus better, because he's the opposite, but in fact, the universe's one true king.
Let's take another break for our sponsor now, and after that we'll hear about your second recording, your family, your next book, and how your career has progressed.
When my mother and father saw that I had leprosy, they said, "You have to leave our home. You have a terrible disease, and if you don't leave, many others will get sick."
This is Shamily Bika. She is 12 years old. She knows that what leprosy has done to others, it can also do to her. Leprosy begins by destroying the sense of touch in the limbs. Without feeling, a person easily injures their hands and feet. Paralyzing deformities often appear. As the years go by, sunken noses further deform the face. Shamily is beginning the fight of her life.
I was very young when I got leprosy, so I know how terrible it is. Look at my hands. Look at my face. If I could wish for anything, it would be that no child would ever suffer this. That every child will be cured of leprosy. That is my prayer.
Leprosy still strikes over 500,000 people a year, many of them children. The cure for leprosy is 3 little pills taken for 6 months or longer until the leprosy bacilli are destroyed. The average cost to cure a person of leprosy is only $20 a month for 1 year, or $240. But most people with leprosy, like Shamily, live in poverty. They simply can't afford the cure. Thousands hope to receive the cure before leprosy destroys their faces, hands, and feet. That's why your help now is so important. Call now and say you'll provide the cure for a person like Shamily. Call American Leprosy Missions at 1-800-543-3131. Your gift is tax deductible. Please call now, 1-800-543-3131.
Welcome back to Defining Moments. We're talking with Dr. Brent Nelson, Chairman of Political Science at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. What's the next recording that you'll take?
Well, this recording isn't really one that people might expect. It's actually a series of tapes issued by InterVarsity Press. It's tapes of N.T. or Tom Wright's series of lectures that he gave at a conference in 1998 that I attended. Mm-hmm. They're based on his book, The Challenge of Jesus.
Any music that you would want to take as well?
Well, you know, Bob, right around that time, I was getting involved in the leading of worship at our church, and I was listening to a lot of worship music. I didn't like a lot of it until I heard a CD called Revival in Belfast by Robin Marks.
A particular song from it?
There is one song. It's one of the slower songs. It's called Jesus, All for Jesus. And it's sung in a way that allows you to feel the commitment that is required of disciples who have decided to follow Jesus. Jesus, all for Jesus.
Let's listen to some of that now. You're married, aren't you? Tell us how you met your wife and a little bit about her.
Well, yes, I am married and happily for 27 years. Lori Olson was a sophomore at Wheaton when I was a freshman, and we met sort of in a French class. In fact, my first class on campus. She was the absolutely stunningly beautiful woman on the other side of the class, and one day I decided I was going to arrange it, engineer it, so that she had to sit next to me. I sat in the class with one empty seat next to me, and she came in late as usual and went to the other side of the class because she had no interest in sitting next to me. So our first sort of meeting was not pleasant. About a year later, though, we met through her roommate, and we've really been best friends ever since.
Oh, great. Do you have children?
We have three children. Our first was born in 1986, Kirsten Grace. She graduated from Furman last year and is now working as a personal trainer in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and will be getting married herself next summer to a guy who still has one more year in college. So it's just like when Lori and I, when Lori had to wait for me, now Kirsten is waiting for Michael.
Is he in college near Chattanooga?
No, he's in college at Furman University, and he happens to be my advisee, which worked out one of those serendipitous moments. But no, Michael and I have been close for a long time, so this is a really joyful thing for us.
Oh, great. And the other two?
Yes. Well, Evan is our firstborn son, and he is a freshman at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. He has taken after me in some way. He runs track and cross country, and he's running for them. He wants to study physics and become a nuclear engineer.
Wow.
And then there's Derek, and Derek's still with us at home.
Okay.
And he's a sophomore at Greenville High School.
Oh, great. You went on to graduate school, of course. Did Lori do that too?
Yeah, actually, Lori was ready to go to graduate school, of course, after we got married. She had been out for a year, and she was accepted to a Master's of Public Health program in Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. So immediately after our honeymoon, like one day later, we packed a 5x7 U-Haul truck, a trailer, and hauled it with our Buick Skylark out to San Francisco, where we had no home, no friends, and just a place to show up at Berkeley. It's an amazing story of how God takes care of people that haven't made proper arrangements. But we just came into the Bay Area with our trailer, and within a day, through the help of God's people, we had a place to live, we had a church to go to, we had friends, and that was in less than 24 hours. So God proved himself faithful at that time in our lives.
How long did you stay out there?
We were there for about a year, and then I had been accepted at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for my graduate training, and so we packed the same size trailer. I don't think it was exactly the same one, and headed back the other way and made it to Madison in time for me to start graduate school in 1982.
And how long were you there?
Too long. 7.5 years. It takes political scientists longer than it takes chemists to get through graduate school, primarily because I had to do field work in Europe, and there's a lot longer. But those were 7.5 great years. Not only did Lori and I deepen our relationship, but we had our first child there. Kirsten was born there. And we were pregnant with Evan when we took off for South Carolina.
And then you went immediately then to Furman.
Yeah. My only connection to Furman prior to that had been that David Whitehurst, a quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, had graduated from Furman. So that was the only thing I knew about Furman, is they had football.
So you had no idea of coming to South Carolina?
Oh, no, no.
So why did you choose to be a college professor?
I wanted to be a believer in a place where people didn't expect believers to be.
Hmm.
And so the default then was to follow my father's footsteps and become an academic, knowing that it was not going to be easy because I had seen my father suffer.
So what's the next book that you'll take to Scribbler's Den? And tell us why it's significant.
Well, I have to put C.S. Lewis in there somewhere. And I think his most significant book was the book he wrote called Miracles. In fact, one of my colleagues who came to Furman as a secular individual, someone who had been raised in a non-churched background, he is a political philosopher, he read Lewis, and he said that Lewis's argument for God was the only airtight argument that he knows, and he can't get around it. And so he has become a believer because of this book.
Are you yourself a writer? And if so, tell us about your work.
Well, I think every academic is a writer. That's one of the things that we have to do. And yes, I do write. I see writing as different than perhaps other academics do. I see myself as a teacher. Sometimes I teach in the classroom. Sometimes I teach on the written page.
Do you have a specialty area?
My specialty is the politics of the European Union. Now, most Americans don't really know very much about the European Union, and Americans might be surprised to know that Europeans don't know much about the European Union either. So I find myself on both sides of the Atlantic teaching people what the European Union is all about. I think it's one of the most significant developments of the 20th century on into the 21st centuries. Now, my specialty within a specialty has become the study of religion and the politics of the European Union. So that's what I do most of my writing.
Have you always been pursuing that religion and politics line?
Not really. In fact, when I started as an academic, I definitely did not want to start studying religion and politics because all the Christians I knew studied religion and politics. But right now I'm involved in a project that is studying the role of religion in shaping European attitudes towards the European Union. Do people like the EU or do they hate it? And I think, and I think I can prove this, that religious culture matters. Being a Catholic makes you more likely to like the EU. Being a Protestant makes you less likely that you will like the EU.
And are you writing about this now?
I am. I've published a series of articles in scholarly journals, and now I'm writing a book that goes deep into the history of Catholicism and Protestantism, and then how those confessional cultures shaped the founding of the European Union in profound ways that still affect politics as they are carried out today in the European Union. So,
well, we don't have time to hear all your conclusions about that, so we will look forward to the book.
Great.
So how about your personal relationship with Jesus now? How do you practice that in your personal life?
Well, yeah, I have a pietist tradition to draw on. My parents were very much products of the Pietist movement. But I began to develop a rhythm to my devotional life in college, where I had to be disciplined. I was in sports, I was studying hard, and so I had to be disciplined, and I began to get up early in the morning and read scripture. I began to pray. I began to think about serving others in a disciplined way. I began to fast. I had a roommate who fasted for 40 days. I still think that that's a record. I know it's not, but I began to fast. And so I learned what it was to be working every day to bring myself before Christ and to bring Christ into my everyday life. So I think one of the other things that has really helped me in my personal relationship with Christ is the presence of small groups in my life. And my kids have grown up in those small groups, and I think that's important.
Hmm. So what are your major continuing passions, and how would you describe, say, your life's mission?
My life's mission, I think, is to be an academic in a secular environment, a Christian academic in a secular environment. I have found the phrase, the integration of faith and learning, to be perhaps the most important thing for me to think about when I think about my mission. I try to integrate my faith, which I believe to be true, into the other true things that I'm learning by exploring, in my case, social relationships, political relationships.
Have you had any particular pushback or difficulties at Furman?
Well, Furman is a good place in many, many ways, but back in the days when we were struggling with our relationship with the Baptists, religion became very, very important and divisive. I was a new faculty member. I was educated at Wheaton College. People suspected that I had an agenda that I think sometimes they rightly suspected me of having that agenda, and other times they accused me of things that I wasn't doing. In one particular incident, before I had tenure, three senior faculty members accused me of advising students to not take their classes for ideological reasons. Now, I was never told who the student or students were that I was advising. I was never told who conveyed this story to the senior faculty members. But the result was they were brought into the dean's office, I was brought into the dean's office, and there was a discussion that occurred, and they accused me of doing this, but they couldn't agree on it. In the end, I was vindicated without saying a word because the accusers fought amongst themselves. But that just illustrates a little bit of what it was like to be identified as a conservative Christian in those days when religion was tough at Furman. Now, I have to say that things have gotten a lot better. And in a pluralistic culture, everybody has their opinion. I have mine. Now the difficulty is making sure that the Christian view is not just one of many, but is one that has some important pull on people's intellectual lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly pray that you're successful. Well, we have to take our third break now, a short break, and we'll hear about your work when we come back, and your second visitor, and the last chapter of your book.
Hello, I'm Chris Doyle, president of American Leprosy Missions. We are proud to sponsor this exciting new radio program, Defining Moments. Leprosy is not a disease that gets much attention anymore. But did you know that every 2 minutes of every day somewhere in the world a person is diagnosed with a new case of leprosy? That is almost 1,000 new cases every day. Many of these cases are precious children. Children like Anna that I met in a hospital in the Philippines. She had been dropped off at the hospital by her parents, and because they were so afraid of leprosy, they never came back to see her. As a parent of four kids, stories like that just break my heart. The good news is that you can make a defining moment in the life of a child like Anna by joining us in delivering the cure for leprosy to children and adults around the world. For over 100 years, ALM has been doing just that, bringing healing and hope in the name of Jesus to those affected by leprosy. Call us today at 1-800-LEPROSY or visit our website at leprosy.org. Thanks for listening and for caring.
Welcome back to Defining Moments. We're talking with Dr. Brent Nelson, Chairman of Political Science at Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. Now, can you tell us a little more about your work at Furman? In particular, I'm interested in whether or not you're able to openly witness or to disciple students in any way.
Well, the short answer is yes. I do consider my work with students to be very, very important and an important part of my mission. And it works out in several ways. First of all, I want to be open enough about my faith, both in the classroom and outside of the classroom, so that students who don't know me personally know that there's a Christian professor on campus who is trying to speak to the issues that are important in everyday campus life, sexuality, politics. But I also want to be identifying students that God seems to have brought into my circle that I should be discipling. I have had a prayer group on Thursday mornings, very early on Thursday mornings, I might add, of guys, of young men, who are committed to praying for the campus. I started it almost 20 years ago now and has gone continuously since then. And I can count, to the glory of God, some great men who have come out of those prayer groups. I don't have an active strategy in that I don't have them go through a book or anything like that when I'm discipling them. What I do is I invite them into my life. I call it discipling by walking around. I say, come and be with me. See what I do. Hang out in my house. Hang out in my office. Watch me. Take my classes. And I think by doing those things, I try to model what it means to be Jesus to a secular campus.
A little bit more about Redeemer Presbyterian. Are you an officer in the church there now?
I am an elder at Redeemer. That has been a process. I wasn't raised a Presbyterian. As I told you, my father was a Baptist preacher, so moving to become a Presbyterian elder has been part of my spiritual formation as well. Putting that aside for a minute, being a person at the heart of a new church effort has been one of the most satisfying experiences of my life. I was warned off it, of course. Anybody who had started a church said, Nelson, make sure you know how expensive this will be in many, many ways. Count the cost. I think I did that, and I tried to get out of it. But a man by the name of Bob Inglis, who is now our congressman, when he wasn't in Congress, he was a restless individual, and he came to me one day and said, you know, we've got to start a church, and we've got to start it near Furman. Will you join me in this? And I said, no. I said, I'm not going to leave a church I love and take my family out of that. He kept coming back. And finally, I said, I am open to praying about this. And through my praying through it and beginning to pray with other people, I caught the vision. A vision that I guess had always been there, but I hadn't let blossom. And now it's been just fantastic. We have been up and running for 7 years. We're building a building. We're now seeing over 100 students come on a Sunday morning. We're a thriving, medium-sized church now. And God has truly blessed, not just the Furman community, but when the kingdom of God comes, it comes to transform everything. So part of that is Furman University, but it's also Travelers Rest, and it's the Paris Mountain community, and it's the Cliffs communities. And we're beginning to see some transformation go on around the church. And that is just to God's praise and to my great satisfaction.
Wonderful. How about one more defining moment?
Well, I've mentioned N.T. Wright already. I mentioned the InterVarsity Conference in 1998. I would say that that was a moment when I was deepest in doubt. And I'm not sure why I signed up for that conference, but I think the Spirit of God had something to do dragging me there. And that's where I first heard Wright, and that's where those tapes came from. It's really that moment, now 10 years ago, that changed my world fundamentally. made Jesus believable, made the faith understandable to me, made me an adult in the faith in many ways.
Who will be your second visitor, and what will you want to discuss?
Well, it's got to be C.S. Lewis. And I want to understand how a man in an academic environment could be as thoroughly converted as C.S. Lewis. I know his writings, but I would love to talk to him as a man and understand what it means for the Spirit of God to be present in a man who thinks as deeply as he did. He understood metaphor better than anybody I know. He brings that into his writing. That means he's keenly observant. And I would like to just walk with him and see what he observes and how that soaked into his own life.
Well, your book's going to have a last chapter. And in that last chapter, you can tell us about your hopes for the future, the things you'd most like your descendants or successors to hear, or any other final words. What do you think will be in your last chapter?
I think in the last chapter, I would like readers to understand how ruined our world really is. Everything about it is corrupted by sin and rebellion. Let me just give you a little example about how modernity has begun to break down our relationships. I hate email. I think email has been one of those modern developments that has broken relationships with other people. Now, part of it is good. It's expanded our network, but it has also made us more anxious because that email is always there, at least for me. I get maybe more than most people do, but I feel oppressed in my relationships with others because now all of those relationships are focused on this one electronic means of communication called email. It's just one example. I think lots of areas of our life are ruined, even by good things that are taken in the wrong direction. But here's the hope. Jesus is about restoring relationships. That's what the kingdom of God is all about. First, it's restoring our relationship with Him, the one true King, the one who brings true peace and prosperity, not just to individuals, but to whole societies. But He also is about restoring relationships with other people. I have just now decided to rebel against email, and I'm picking up the phone a lot more, or I'm talking to people one-on-one. It's my little mini rebellion against the kingdom of the world in favor of what I think is the kingdom of God, a kingdom where human beings connect in a way that allows them to love one another.
Mm. I think we all ought to do that more, and I catch myself saying, I've sat here for 5 minutes writing this thing. I could have said to this person in 2 minutes on the telephone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very good advice. Brent Nelson, thank you again for sharing your life with us. It's been an interesting, very interesting, and most inspiring. And it's wonderful to know that someone in the Academy is faithfully serving the Lord Jesus. And we just pray that He will continue to bless you and your work at Furman University. We appreciate you, and we thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Bob.
And to all our listeners, you can hear this and past programs at DefiningMomentsRadio.com. Please tell others about that. There you can also suggest someone to be interviewed, and please send us your comments about the program. That's DefiningMomentsRadio.com. Thanks very much again for joining us today, and please make a defining moment in the life of someone with leprosy by making that call or visiting leprosy.org today.
Defining Moments is a production of Omichi Media in conjunction with Altitude Audio. To suggest a person to be interviewed, email a brief description to subject@definingmomentsradio.com.